This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. This week's episode is with a couple that makes phenomenal cider up in New Hampshire at Farnham Hill. It's all orchard-based from their own land at Poverty Lane Orchards, and it's all made right there on site in a repurposed barn. Steve Wood and Louisa Spencer have made a life with their cider. But in recent years, as the sort of pseudo-craft cider boom has created both momentum and vulnerability in the cider category, things have gotten a bit out of whack. After all, what is craft cider if it's not up to par with orchard-based traditional cider? It's a bit like starting up a craft beer craze when you already have Hill Farmstead and Jester King around. But that's exactly what's happened in cider, as these traditional orchardists have had to start competing alongside some fairly mundane cider that comes in a six-pack of cans. It's a blessing and a curse. The size of the pie increases, but the consumer is more confused than ever before. But despite that quandary, Farnham Hill is growing. They're building an entirely new cider house next to the old barn, and hoping the future is as bright as it seems. I stopped by on a whim. I was simply in the area for a wedding this past summer, and wasn't going to miss my chance to visit one of my favorite cider producers in the world. So this interview starts a bit spontaneously, as Steve just expected a chat, and I quickly realized that him and his partner Louisa needed to sit down and talk some things out with me. And thankfully, I had my road kit with me so that we could record. It'll start abruptly and end just as abruptly, but that's what oral history sounds like sometimes, and I treasure this conversation. This is Steve Wood and Louisa Spencer of Farnham Hill. Listen in.
Also, I mean, other things too. I guess there's more.
That's the way it always goes. The weirdest technologies are always invented for either shopping or pornography. That's how
that
goes.
That's right.
Terrific. Yeah.
Well, or going to the moon, but then the guy gets spun off into idiocy.
Just throw that over there.
I imagine everybody has. That Tickle Me Elmo had more software than the first moon landing.
Jesus.
I am not surprised. All right. Why don't I get you guys a little closer together? I'm going to have this right in between you.
Okay.
Oh, that's all right.
That's an omen.
That's what you get for trying to get us closer together.
All right. So let's begin by introducing yourselves so our listeners know who's speaking when. Go ahead and start with you.
I'm Louisa Spencer. I'm the mom of this mom and pop operation.
And I'm Steve Wood, the pop.
That's right. Just a minute ago, I think we should just start here because I think it'll kind of set the frame for the rest of the things that we talk about that are important to you. Just a few minutes ago, you mentioned that you're not sure if there's going to be a future for orchard-based ciders.
Well, there's a real foundational problem here, which is that all of the ciders, craft ciders, which are mostly defined as cleverly flavored ciders, are based on relatively indifferent apples or concentrate. We have nothing against that, but those apples are bought. It's a waste market. Those are the apples that are left over after the value's already been taken out of the crop of Honeycrisp or whatever high-value eating apple has been produced, or they're leftovers that nobody can sell. But nobody would plant an apple for the price that nobody in his right mind would plant an apple for the price that they're paying for all that stuff. Just to give you an idea, the concentrates about $1 a gallon. Say that translates to about $3 a bushel. These cheap apples, sometimes you can get them for $1.85. Three is high. Five is very high. We sell fruit for $25. I know very few growers who would plant an apple tree for less than about an anticipated $16 or $17 a bushel. So it's not a closable gap.
Right.
And so when cider makers say, oh, we're going to run out of apples, we've got to engage some apple growers. Yeah, apple growers who know about this, like us, say, well, you know, you're going to have to think this through a little bit because your raw material price is going to go up by five times. We can say that and at the same time say that given what the craft that's developing in cider actually is, which has all to do with flavoring more than anything else, I'm not sure. I mean, actually, I can say I am sure that the variety of apple isn't very important to that.
Yeah.
The quality of the apples aren't very important to that. And now that, of course, this is a way broader statement than it can be. And this is, and we don't denigrate any of this stuff. We don't have, we have no, you know, this is not a value judgment or anything. It's just an observation from people who've been growing apples for decades and decades and decades.
That, yeah, it seems like you've been recontextualized a bit as a result of craft cider becoming sort of its own nascent category.
Well, it's a kind of, I mean, I think the whole thing began because the first mass market cider appeared in a six pack. Mm-hmm. And so in the eyes of the consumer, it began to be configured as beer, as a sort of gluten-free beer. And then as it began to swell and diversify and so on, people were looking for many more and more ways to differentiate themselves. Then, you know, and then it was like flavored with coca bean, whatever. But there's also, I mean, the fact that we get so much money for our surplus apples means there is a market for them, which means there is...
Surplus cider apples.
Surplus cider apples, right, cider apples.
Means ones we
which means
eat.
There is a... there's a market for them because there are a whole lot of quite serious cider makers who want that special quality that serious cider apples, which will never appear in a pie or a lunchbox, that they lend. But it is a kind of a different market. I mean, it's not snobby and it's not geeky. It's just based on the land. But there's only certain things you can do within the supply that now exists to get the full flavor that we prefer. And given the prices we're getting for what are fundamentally processing apples, we're a little nervous about the large plantings that are now going in because the people putting them in are used to growing grocery apples. Hmm. And they may not have what it takes to let them soften and ripen and sweeten and get funky the way they need to for the best cider. So you know, the nightmare is they pick them crisp and green and they sell them for $20 and they don't have any flavor and the reputation of the variety is trashed, which would really stink. So, you know, there's a million ways to see our little effort as kind of dwindling down to nothing. But on the other hand, people love the stuff. I do a lot of store tastings, and people who say, I don't like cider, I'm not a cider person, I'm going, it's dry, it's local, dry, and then they go, oh, that's delicious, and the big hook is for the extra dry, so there's not a speck of sugar in this, mm-hmm. Oh, and then they, you know, all kinds of people, thin, fat, young, old, you know, covered in wall bar dust, or sporting the Ralph Lauren, it's, a lot of people just go, oh. But it's a slow, slow build, and it has been ever since the beginning.
And there's an expectation that was created from the outset. Again, it was Woodchuck that started it, bless their hearts, but they, which was to make the fermented cider taste like apples. And the only way you can do that is by returning apple juice or apple concentrate to the stuff, which is about the equivalent of somebody taking a nicely fermented bottle of wine and then pouring grape juice back into it to hide the wine-like characteristics of it. All the things that we're doing and others like us are doing is striving to express the fruit that's grown for the characteristics that it gets from fermentation or that it lends to a fermented drink. And so if you're just going to sweeten it back or flavor it back to make it taste, remind people of apple pie in their, you know, grade school days, there's no reason to grow or sell all these complex apples. And on the variety front, I mean, just last year, you could buy a ton of Cabernet Sauvignon in the Central Valley of California for about one-tenth what you could buy it for in Napa Valley. That's because a processing industry, wine, has developed the ability to evaluate the difference in worth that one variation on the theme of an identical variety confers on their product. They can evaluate that against the other. And so there's a place for the cheap Cabernet Sauvignon in jug wines and all kinds of other stuff. And there's a place for the expensive Cabernet Sauvignon because the processing industry knows about the qualitative differences. And we know that the cider industry has not reached that state yet. We're not sure that it's going to reach that state fast enough to really distinguish between good Dabinet and other Dabinet or whatever. And we're feeling a little funny about this since we did have a little bit to do with the start of the whole industry in the first place, and we've had a great deal to do with the propagation of all these apple varieties all over the country. I mean, most of the stuff came from here.
Most
originally.
Of the DNA comes out of here. You know, because Steve gives away Budwood. And so then they take it home and they, you know, and woo. And so we'll just have to see. I mean,
yeah,
I don't know.
Like, what are you
I mean,
do?
Yeah. So, maybe a new preachy association for the propagation of real cider apples and please pay the money or something.
Yeah, the unintended consequences of generous collegiality, I guess, are just, you know, whoa, wait, what are you doing over there? But that's sort of where we are now, and it's not, there's no other road here. I mean, there's no, as I say, the difference between $3 and $25, there are no dials to turn.
My ideal customer is somebody who gets tired of the six-pack stuff, gets tired of sugar, and gets a reasonable source of income and finds our stuff, and just instead of seeing it as something that will pass and be replaced by something new, see it as something they stay with. You know, our original vision, kind of an annoying word, but our original vision was that cider would become something that any good host would keep around, like a beer and a red wine and a white wine and a good cider. Full stop. Preferably a regional cider. Yeah. Preferably a cider that reflects the terroir of the neighborhood and inspires local pride. As you can see, it was quite a florid vision. And as you can see, it hasn't gotten off the ground in most places. Some places. Yeah. In California, I think there's more of that because they have more of an agricultural consciousness out there. And it's so much more important to the economy generally. But anyway.
Like wine, you can't produce these characteristics without the right varieties in the right sort of condition. I mean, maybe international flavors and fragrances can make a really good Burgundy, but if they could, why haven't they done so already?
It's probably more expensive than just growing the
damn grapes. Right, exactly. just by any regular food processing methods, you can't replicate this stuff without the fruit. You can replicate most of the other things that are actually going into cider now, and even
Wait
if it's
minute.
Not artificial, I'm not sure that the difference between good concentrate, I mean, the cheapest possible, or rather, fruit or juice coming from the cheapest possible market for a lot of the purposes the juice is being put to, the value of the things is just about equal. I mean, the less you care about the characteristics.
Yeah, but when you talk about going into cider, you don't mean cider like ours.
I'm talking about cider.
Right.
I'm talking about the waste.
It sounded
as
though you suddenly.
I'm talking about.
They could fake cider, but they can't fake Burgundy.
I'm sorry. They could fake. They can't fake the cider that we make and that Eleanor Leger makes and that Adam Stoschek makes and that all people across the country make. All those people are doing the same thing we're doing in one way or another. I thought you said we weren't geeks. Anyway.
Well, it's an adjective that describes the kind of people we are.
So it's not, just like the grapes. It's not replicable by any other means. The big question is whether anybody gives a damn except this small, cluster of people who adore it, who we've encountered and have given us enormous,
encouragement.
Encouragement, and we thought, gosh, it was early 2000s. All of a sudden, we're getting written up in the New York Times and Food and Wine and, all this stuff. Martha Stewart, before she started to smell bad, we're getting written up by all these things. And thinking, good, we're set. We've got that. I mean, we're acknowledged hot sommeliers in New York and elsewhere falling all over the stuff. It took us a little while to realize that did not a market make. And that as soon as the article stopped, wine shop didn't know where to put the cider. And there was a period after which you couldn't keep suggesting they put it in front of the cash register. Yeah. And it winds up in the back, dusty shelves with the Manischewitz.
Well,
the
sort
wine.
Of zoo, peppermint schnapps, because it was only one.
Yeah, we'd find our cider in the most depressing corners of stores. There's still a little bit of that.
Sort of the menagerie corner.
Yeah, that's changed a bit. Yeah, and in all of this, there's another thing. I mean, a lot of the six-pack guys are, they're really good colleagues and good guys. I've known many of these, or we've known many of these people for a long time. Even back in the early days, the Woodchuck guys, and we knew that we didn't want to be on the shelf next to each other. Because if you would like Woodchuck, and you come get a bottle of Extra Dry, you're never going back to the next cider, and vice versa. If you would have liked our Extra Dry, take the Woodchuck, you're done. Right? So we understood that we needed to be some distance, either vertical or horizontal, away from each other.
On some kind of spectrum.
And what we realized in those early days is that there was no category. And so we really did kind of set the work trying to make one appear. And that's where all the encouragement for other cider makers, you know, we do not play our cards very close to the breast. And,
the idea was to keep orchard land under orchards instead of growing houses, as they say around here. I mean, the whole of upstate New York, to listen to Chuck Schumer, you'd think he invented cider. Governor Cuomo was like, oh, New York leads the way. Hello? You know, the first New York Cider Week, they needed us because they didn't have enough cider makers in New York. So we are honorary New York cider makers ever since.
We grow a lot of New York and Vermont apples as well.
Yeah, well, never mind. Yeah, our stuff gets trucked into other people's terroir and does duty for. But, you know, it's all part of getting something started. And the point is this. We are not powerful marketers. We are not sources of the novelty of the week. We are not great producers of beer wit, which is this strange kind of copywriting that makes bros feel like they're witty. And, we just can't do any of that, so scratch that market. And meanwhile, are there enough people willing to fight their way through the noise to even find our stuff? I mean, retailers can't stay awake long enough to see all the reps that are coming in showing them cider. We know one guy who just went out of business, a distributor who went out of business, because he was specializing in cider. And when the number of brands, sextupled or whatever it did, he simply couldn't get enough appointments to keep his place going. So he quit. So it's basically, that's how it is. And we'll just have to see. Thank God for farm lending, which is infinitely elastic. It's like, we'll pay next year.
We're not quite sure.
If it comes down to the finish, they'll just grow houses on this land and everybody will be paid off. But anyway.
If there is any do-goody aspect of what we've been doing all along, it's what Louise has just said, which is that we are trying to use what we know and our advantages to do that, to try to make it possible to grow.
Well, fruit growing is basically a madness. It is a warped attitude.
Come on.
You can call it an addiction for years, except there's too much addiction around now. Anyway.
But it's, these are almost separate industries developing as one, and the one we're in isn't one. It's not that, I mean, if there's a prospect, at least in the near term, for these orchard ciders, it is a real subcategory. And meanwhile, the thing that a lot of our colleagues in the real cider, whatever you want to call it, orchard cider category segment, whatever that is, are reluctant to acknowledge how cider is becoming construed in the American mind and what constitutes good cider and craft. I mean, the word craft is, boy, that's a tough one.
Well, it's like the word dry,
But craft, but there's a lot of craft in using the right chipotle.
That's right, put the right tea bag, whatever.
Exactly, and that's the craft that's being honored in this developing market. And even wine writers, they call up now, they say, so what's new at Farnham Hill? It's like,
We have a new crop.
We've got another crop. We haven't screwed it up yet. We're trying to make it better. What's new? Cinnamon? What do you want me to tell you?
Last year and the year before. Dumbness. Anyway, Steve, we should stop talking and get some photographs for these nice people.
We'll let them bid us, girlfriend.
Okay. All I'm saying is that the man said an hour and half an hour's gone by.
He takes as many pictures as he wants, girlfriend.
Okay. We are very, very, very conscious of people's time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can tell. I'm going to ask my second question now.
Oh. Your first one was a big question, pal. What are you going to do?
I had a feeling you might get rolling. So you've hinted at that you have become somewhat of a supplier to other cider makers and other people who are getting orchards going. And that there's there's inherent risk in being that collegial, of course, in a category that's kind of topsy-turvy right now as to what's what, right? Mm-hmm. Whether they grow the fruit, pick the fruit right, process it right, make the kind of ciders that are going to support the category. You're putting a lot of people into motion that can help or hurt, despite your best wishes. Mm-hmm. Is that really a threat to you overall? Because you make such a small amount of cider, really, in the grand scheme of things.
Right. No, I mean, it's a potential threat. It's always been a potential threat, and we need to make more cider in order to make this thing make any sense. But again, we realize that unless And we're arrogant, right? We think we can stay on top of the pile. You can't play king on the mountain on a pane of glass, right? There was no mountain. And so we perceive that we need more good cider for us to be struggling to stay on the qualitative top of all that. I mean, again, we're not worried about whether we're going to slide down the hill. We're worried about the fact that there still isn't enough sort of foundation here for a market. And that's much more of a threat than the threat of somebody making. I mean, we're thrilled. Autumn Stojic just got some beautiful reviews, his Eve's Cidery from Parker, among others, for some brilliant cider that I think is better than anything we've ever made. She doesn't agree with that. But, you know, it's delightful to see stuff like see colleagues making really good cider and getting it acknowledged. And that does us nothing but good. You know, it would be fabulous to be in the circumstance where we had to really worry about whether some other good cider maker, good real cider maker, was outselling us at the moment.
Well, it's really, I mean, I think, you know, to get recognition, there has to be more than one of you, unless you're Evel Knievel. In my dreams, the cider market, the market for orchard ciders becomes more regional. That's how regional character actually develops. When people say New England style cider, all they mean was they put like cinnamon in it or something. But in fact, New England style cider should be made from apples that were grown in New England and reflect that. As this is happening in the Finger Lakes, their ciders tend to be grouped around a sharp, scouring kind of profile, which is very fruity, but it's not, you know, soothing. It's kind of bracing and up. And in my dreams, the cider market in the States gets deep enough that we don't have to send it all over creation, that people will drink it locally and be proud of it locally, and there's less trucking, and everybody gets their regional identity, and everybody's happy. That would be great, but so far we're, you know, eons from
that. We take the regional identity among other regional identities. I mean, as Louisa says, the Finger Lakes, Virginia, there's a cluster of people making mm-hmm. cider in Virginia from the same varieties of apples.
Yeah, and it seems to have a character, you know, in common, time and a sorta.
But until recently, you know, there's the Iowa style of cider, which means there's a guy in Iowa making cider, you know, that is now the Iowa state, you know, and we laugh at the New England ciders that enter competitions.
Oh, well, yeah.
Oh, my God. The definitions of that.
But the biggest, the most powerful word that I've noticed out there is local.
Yeah.
You can sell a local mud pie once, you know, they might not buy the next one, but there's something magic about the word local. So people come bombing in the entrance of the liquor store, and I'm there with my little table. I say, you want to try a dry New Hampshire cider? And they say, oh, it's local. And they turn, even though they're beelining for the vodka. And I mean, I'm exaggerating somewhat because the real vodka beeliners, no, they can't hear anything. However, that's the strongest thing. People yeah. just feel as though they can afford to give a little attention to whatever's local. People just read New Hampshire and they see New York, so they think it's local there. Literally,
they see
the new and they fill in New Hampshire. So we fill in New York, which is very, very helpful.
But people do also. I mean, when people are at a place, I mean, you don't drink Chateauneuf du Pape in the Napa Valley,
right.
And when you're in some city, and you're getting a beer. People routinely now ask what's local beer is.
Right.
So it's. I mean, the notion of locale is becoming.
Yeah, and
much
that
stronger.
May offer. The orchard cider makers, their best
edge.
Hope. Yeah. You know, we'll see. I mean, also, though, we have to admit, of the mass market ciders, they're creating a huge intake of cider drinkers, of whom maybe 10% will refine their taste and want to move on.
If 10% refine their taste, everybody's also, we're all set.
Yeah, exactly.
10%.
I mean, that's a lot of peeps.
That's a lot of peeps.
So we love and admire everybody who's bringing those 21-year-olds into cider, and of course the kids who are drinking it in college without legitimacy. But then, you know, we hope that a few of them, when they get a job and get sick of sugar, will seek out better cider.
And that is actually happening a bit. And the difference between what this and what we were doing, particularly Louisa, back in like 2000, pounding the pavement in New York or wherever, trying to explain to wine distributors what cider was, or hearing things like, oh, never mind, we've already got a cider, we've got a French cider. You say, like, you got a couple thousand wines here, how about two ciders? How about, you know, what a great idea, you know? But it's way now, at least beyond, if you say cider, something springs to just about every American's mind now that is not, that is alcoholic. If you said cider 15 years ago or 10 years ago, it was sweet cider, period. And you had to hold on to them for a minute and talk, force them to listen to you, explain to you that that's not what cider is in most countries in the world. So that has been fixed. And the observation, well, Lulu only said part of it about the extra dry hitting. The thing is that it's just in the last year, really, that our extra dry is suddenly in our own little, you know, our own little flight of ciders, extra dry is just suddenly started to smoke everything else. And our sweetest ciders are dead dusty dry compared to most. But I mean, I saw this in New York during the Cider Week public tastings last year, and it was amazing. I'd never seen it before. Yeah. And the Lulu and the folks who are pouring for us here and there now are seeing a pretty consistent pattern.
But the sugar rebound is finally setting in.
It could also be that, I mean, the whole part of our point of our adding sugar to this stuff is to make the things a little more approachable, not to make them sweet, to bring out the fruit, whatever all else. I think people could just be getting a little bit subtler, and they're detecting the thing that is in the original, that's in the cider itself.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That they're okay with tasting what's really there and not a wall of sugar.
I see what you mean.
GBH is made possible by the financial contributions of our underwriters. Our Fervent Few community, a growing community of GBH fans, including some professional supporters like Hops and Grain down in Austin, Texas, Cloudwater Brew Co. in Manchester, Demos Pizza in Chicago, Four Pier Brewing in London, and the Mitten Bar up in Ludington, Michigan, Yeastie Boys from New Zealand and the UK, and Sound Growler Brewing from Tinley Park, Illinois, all support us through their monthly professional subscriptions. And Guinness, our first major underwriter, helping us bring you a completely new series of stories called Coming to America, featuring upstart and iconic breweries from around the world who are trying to make their way in the U.S. in the age of local. As part of the Guinness Coming to America section, we'll be featuring new wave breweries as well as long-standing imports, like this month's focus on the stateside launch of Birra Impania from Italy and Australian Brewery. We're thrilled to be digging into these stories, and like this podcast and many of our other projects, Coming to America wouldn't be possible without our underwriting support from companies like Guinness. Watch for more underwriters and new themes like Coming to America in the coming months.
What makes your cider, what are the distinctive components, whether it's ingredient and process, of the ciders that you're making?
Well, it's that it's the best cider in America and the world, and that's really what distinguishes it from all.
There are some people that would agree with that.
I could tell you what's underneath it, which is real serendipity, which is that we were first experimenting back in the 80s with all these grafting trials and hundreds of varieties, trying to find any, that would grow to a very high standard here. We found a bunch of bittersweets, and I pretty much decided not to plant much in the way of sharp fruit because I reckoned there'd be enough sharp fruit. And again, we didn't really know what we were doing then, but horticulturally we did. I mean, I've been growing apples my whole life, so even then we had some experience with that and with this land. But we, at the same time as we were taking the cider gamble, we also planted a bunch of apples for specialty fresh market. We call them heirlooms, whatever. I mean, our label was uncommon apples, because heirlooms doesn't really mean anything to us,
because you could sell them for three times what you sell Macintosh.
Right. But there's an amusing fact that Macintosh and Red Delicious are older than many of the apples that people sell as heirlooms.
But that's not our case. So we
planted all these things, that Golden Russet, Esopus Spitzenberg, Ashmead's Kernel, Wixen, a bunch of varieties that we weren't intending for cider, but most of which were wicked acidic. And it was over the course of the next 6 years or so, when we were actually starting to learn a bit about making cider, at least. We didn't feel like rank amateurs anymore. We had a couple packing room mistakes where people just produced too many culls of these valuable apples. What the hell, let's make a, you know, put them in a barrel. That stuff was stunning as a source of acid. Not all of them. I mean, some of them were awful, but Spitz, the ones I just named, were turned out to go amazingly well with as grown here, Dabonet, Yarlington Mill, Ellis Bitter, all the rest of those, they were a beautiful source of acidity for those. Each of them weirdly has about very close acidities. That's close pH, close titratable, you know, and it's all malic acid. But they all come in enormously different packages. Some of them are floral, one of them is really kind of grapey, one of them is kind of vegetal. So all of a sudden we had this. We started thinking about those as cider apples more than anything else, and this was also...
Well, Wixen was a cider apple originally.
Originally, that's right.
California cider apple.
But we were selling it...
Back before Prohibition ruined everything.
But we planted it for the fresh market, and we were growing and growing it more or less successfully.
Yeah, they're delicious. They're really fun to eat.
When I say it's serendipity, we had collection of varieties going into our cider that didn't exist anywhere else in the world. That was not by design. It was total happenstance. I mean, we did do all of the things of the variety trials and everything else. So we did. There was a lot of design working toward this. That wasn't part of the plan, and it's still basic to our fruit. There are a few things. One is that when we think about bittersweets, we don't think about making an English style or a French style cider. We're trying to make a delicious cider by our lights that reflects the fruit we grow. And so, unlike most of those other ciders and a lot of American ciders that are based on bittersweets, we're not trying to give you sort of bittersweet in your face. We're using the bittersweet more as a sort of structural element and look at, you know, to hold up all the other. I mean, is this too wonky?
This is perfect.
So using a bit of these different sources of acidity or golden russet, which has become our fruit bomb. I mean, it's got just about our target acidity, so we can't use it to acidulate. You can't use it to go the other direction, but you can drop a basket of fruit in the tank. Our ciders are, they are
American.
The way they are because of the, yeah, we don't,
immigrant
there is
apples.
No, we don't grow cider in a style. And we got traditional stuff on our labels, and we're always getting praised for European style ciders, fine. But if there was an epiphany here in the late 90s, I think, and we were tasting, it was before we'd really figured out how to set the sensory analysis thing. But we realized that we were encountering aromas and flavors from the things that we were growing here, that was, in those days, we were trying to make an English style cider and planning to make a French style cider after we got that one down. And we realized we were encountering really pleasing flavors and aromas that we'd never encountered in any other ciders. And we kind of looked at each other. There were a few of us. One of us was English. So why are we trying to make an imitative cider? Why don't we just take the fruit we grow and make something that's delicious?
Americans.
Yeah, and make something that's delicious to us and reflective of the stuff. And that, if our style, if there is such, was born, it was on that day, that we just stopped trying to imitate and started trying to figure this stuff out. And I mean, one of the other things that I think distinguishes us, it's not from everybody, but we really take sensory analysis seriously. And we didn't, that was also sort of luck. There are five of us, Lulu and I are two of the five, who started tasting together 15, 16 years ago, just sort of figuring out how to do it. But we developed this sort of rigorous, descriptive.
We took a course,
but the course didn't teach us how to do it.
It
just lowered the barrier.
It
lowered the barrier, gave us a beginning format, and we thought, well, we ought to try to do this. And we really worked hard at it.
And then we found that anybody who walks in the door and gets a job here can learn to do it.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a genius. You don't have to have a special nose.
Yeah.
You just have to know what to pay attention to. And weirdly, this vocabulary forms, which is usable among us. And then every now and then, I'm skimming through Parker, and I find that something we thought we came up with is out there. Which proves that language works.
But our deal is we're not looking for causality, and nothing's pejorative, nothing's complimentary, and we're not trying to figure out where it came from. And we're trying to avoid thinking about that. We're trying to describe the nose, describe the taste, describe the feel, and describe the finish. Then we start talking about what's good and what's bad and what goes together and why it stinks like a pond or whatever. And that has, not only has it developed, we've developed obviously a language that's constantly evolving as new people come in and say words like bubblegum or artichoke to us, which is really cool. We just tell people to, you know, cast their minds widely into their experience. And, you know, if you smell peach and dog shit, you say peach, dog shit, and you know, those two things, the combination of apples grown grown in a place where we were able to judge them to grow to a very high standard because of the time we'd spent growing apples in this thing. And the combination of the sensory analysis and the effort to just let those apples be reflected. And it, of course, this is, as time's gone on, driven our plantings and whatever all else. I mean, we're narrowing down the number of things that we're trying to grow for this cider. But it has been like muddling around in a dark closet. But the cider is, I mean, the cider, it's nice to, you know, I mean, people are growing all this fruit, and a lot of people are, I mean, we give a lot of, we're kind of diffident about it, but we're free with advice. And, you know, a lot of people have picked up some of the stuff we do and some of the, you know, we catch some of the same aromas and flavors emerging from other people's ciders.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's only so much you can sense in this world.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, is that... That's,
okay.
It ain't the level of fizz.
The daylight is changing to a rain light.
Questions?
I'll ask some more while we walk around. This was really fantastic,
foundational
stuff for me, and I feel like I understand where you're coming from.
Good.
Sound good? Thanks so much for that.
Not at all. No, delighted. Would you like to taste ciders? Would you like to look at orchards? Most of the cider orchards are not at this farm, but we can walk up to one that's here that has a much more problem.
Thanks for listening this week, folks. This past week, we published a critical drinking interview with Kevin Nolan of the mayor of Old Town, a bar in Fort Collins. Matthew Curtis has a discussion with him about the new competition between brewery taprooms and bars that sparked an incredible conversation in the beer industry, one of our most popular interviews ever. Matthew also brought us the story of Lost and Grounded in Bristol in the south of the UK. It's a journeyman and a journeywoman's tale through multiple breweries on this couple's way to starting their own, and by any account, excelling. We also published our latest Fervent Few community article, sharing perspectives on the inclusiveness of the craft beer community, or lack thereof. Members of our subscriber community weigh in on some label artwork they've found off-putting, and positive examples of instances where breweries went out of their way to welcome a wider audience. If you weren't already aware, we started a subscription club for GBH called The Fervent Few, where you can contribute financially to the content you love and get access to exclusive gear, our community forum, and we invite you to share your experiences and opinions on a weekly topic. It's been a great way to bring our readers together with our writers for some compelling discussion. You should join. If you'd like to support GBH, we use Patreon as a way that our readers and listeners can subscribe with a monthly contribution, just like subscribing to a magazine. Visit patreon.com/goodbeerhunting or click on the link in our show notes. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.